Good evening, this is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in downtown Madison. Here are the headlines for this evening.
Donald Trump leads President Joe Biden by 2% in Wisconsin, according to a survey of registered voters released today by the Marquette Law School poll. With less than 7 months before Election Day, 51% of registered voters in Wisconsin say they prefer Trump, up 2 percentage points from January. Biden's preferable numbers have stayed consistent at 49%. That difference is within the poll's margin of error, plus or minus 4.8 percentage points. The poll was conducted over the course of a week earlier this month and surveyed 814 registered voters in the state. The poll also found that in Wisconsin, overall enthusiasm for voting is considerably lower than the same presidential matchup 4 years ago.
Meanwhile, the same poll shows Democratic incumbent Tammy Baldwin leading Republican Eric Hovde in the race for U.S. Senate in Wisconsin. Baldwin polls 52% and Hovde 47% among registered voters. The two are tied among those categorized as likely voters. This was the first Marquette poll taken since Hovde entered the race in February. And as the race heats up, more voters are taking notice of the candidates. 11% of voters say they haven't heard enough about Baldwin. That's down from 22% last June. 56% of voters say they haven't heard enough about Hovde. That's down from 85% who said they did not know enough about the man last June.
Wisconsin has the highest percentage of fatal crashes due to wrong-way drivers in the country, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Commission. From the years 2013 to 2022, deadly crashes involving wrong-way drivers accounted for over 9% of all fatal crashes in Wisconsin, more than double the national average of 3.5% during the same time span. Factors that increase the risk of these kinds of fatal car crashes include drunk driving, nighttime driving, older drivers, and driving alone. According to a national AAA study released in 2021, 60% of fatal wrong-way collisions involve drunk driving, and 78% of wrong-way accidents happen at night. Highways with on- and off-ramps close to each other are the type of intersection that can most often lead to wrong-way crashes, according to the Wisconsin State Journal. In 2012, Wisconsin was an early adopter among states implementing a wrong-way alert system to help reduce the number of head-on collisions. Wisconsin is also known to be one of the most lenient states in penalties for drunk driving and has one of the highest rates of drunk driving in the nation.
The Dane County Board of Supervisors re-elected Patrick Miles as their chair for a second term at a meeting last night. Miles lives in McFarland and represents District 34, which includes the towns of Dunn and Blooming Grove, as well as the village of McFarland. He's been a member of the county board since 2006. In the wake of County Executive Joe Parisi retiring next month, Miles will also serve in the role until he selects an interim replacement before an election is then held in November. The Board of Supervisors is the legislative body for Dane County and has 37 seats. We'll have more about city leadership change-ups later on in the show.
Dane County is getting federal recognition for its leadership in encouraging solar power, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. On Monday, Dane County became the first in the nation to receive a platinum designation from a U.S. Department of Energy program that assists municipalities in implementing access to solar energy. Municipal leaders in solar energy within Dane County are McFarland, Mount Horeb, and Middleton. Sun Prairie leads the way with nearly 275 solar installations alone. Last year, Dane County became the first county in Wisconsin to achieve 100% renewable offset electricity.
Madison's Contemporary Art Museum is getting its next director. It's a homecoming for incoming director Paul Baker Prindle, who has degrees from UW-Madison and Edgewood College and has worked at the former iteration of the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. He'll start in the position in about 3 weeks and replace outgoing director Christina Brungart, whose leadership saw the reopening of the museum after the pandemic lockdown, as well as pushback from community members from the museum's handling of assault and vandalism during an art show highlighting Black artists. And those were the day's headlines. Now onto the rest of the day's top stories.
The agenda for yesterday's Common Council meeting was packed, from electing new leadership to a resolution affirming their support for survivors of domestic violence and abuse. But Alders struggled to follow procedure in light of recent allegations against one of their colleagues. WORT News producer Faye Parks has the details.
Madison Alders met for more than 4 hours last night. They spent nearly an hour of that time on a resolution that later passed with unanimous approval. The resolution, affirming unwavering support for survivors of domestic violence and abuse, comes after one Alder on the body, Charles Miadze of the city's North Side, was recently accused of domestic abuse by two of his former romantic partners. He has denied the allegations, calling them, quote, entirely baseless, defamatory, and without merit, unquote. He was not in the room while his colleagues and guest speakers discussed the resolution, sparking criticism from one of his constituents, Veronica Figueroa, who said yesterday,
Mr. Miadze, your lack of presence here today speaks volumes to one of your constituents. You have failed us. Your lack of accountability and misleading messages continue to cause harm to those you have impacted.
Over the course of the discussion, Mayor Rhodes Conway interrupted numerous times to remind speakers that they were only permitted to discuss the resolution against domestic violence and were not allowed to make direct references to Alder Miadze.
Veronica, the item before us is a resolution.
I have been silently reading the post in regards to Alder Charles Madison in his domestic violence against some of women in our community.
Balthazar, speaking to any specific case is not appropriate at this time.
For me, due process hangs on two things from two ends.
Alder, the resolution doesn't speak to process within the city.
I'm talking about, so if you'll let me finish, I'm talking about the commentary that speaks to the process. It's real quick.
The commentary is not relevant, Alder. It's the resolution that's before us that you need to address. Alder, please address the resolution in front of us.
And while Alder Miadze was not present, he is registered as a co-sponsor of the resolution. For that reason, several of his colleagues withdrew their support.
I know that I am registered as a sponsor of this resolution, but seeing the other sponsors, I cannot in good faith want to be a part of that list, so please take me off of the sponsorship list.
That was Alder Juliana Bennett of Central Madison. She went on to express her belief that the resolution was performative and real action was needed. Alder Sabrina Madison of the Far East Side introduced the resolution. And she countered last night that, in addition to supporting the resolution, the council can also take action against Alder Miadze.
Then it sounds like we have alders who are also in support of censuring maybe someone on our body. That's more than platitudes. To be action-oriented over platitudes is what the community needs from us.
City Attorney Mike Haas tells WORT that unnamed alders on the Common Council have reached out to him to determine the process for removing a colleague from office, but have so far only asked general questions. He says that there are state statutes in place for them to do so.
The statutes require that there be a hearing. There's a standard that has to be met. It's called for cause, which means inefficiency, neglect of duty, official misconduct, or malfeasance in office.
But he also says that these situations are rare, and as a result, the standards have not been clearly defined in court. It's the same story for constituents in Alder Miadze's district who wish to initiate a recall. Meanwhile, the Common Council elected its new president. Alder Figueroa Cole of the Far West Side replaces outgoing president Jael Curry. Figueroa Cole moves into the position from her former role as vice president.
My decision to seek this seat is now rooted on the council's tradition of moving to VP from president. Rather, it is driven by my unwavering belief in continuity and my confidence in my ability to tackle process improvements and complex issues such as the budget.
Alder Figueroa Cole earned 11 of the votes last night, while the other nominee, Alder Bill Tischler of the Near West Side, earned 8. Alder John Duncan of the Far West Side is the council's new vice president, winning 12 votes to Alder Barbara Harrington McKinney's 7. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
A new report released today by Wisconsin Policy Forum finds that Wisconsin's current finances are the strongest on record. According to the nonpartisan research organization, federal pandemic relief and careful spending are the primary contributors. But are these numbers destined to be just a flash in the pan? Our news producer, Faye Park, spoke to Jason Stein, research director at the Policy Forum, to get his take on Wisconsin's uncertain financial future.
Thank you for joining me, Jason.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So in your report published today, you analyzed Wisconsin's current financial state. What, in your opinion, are the main takeaways?
The state's financial position is exceptionally strong. You know, we are mainly looking at where the state was in the summer of 2023. On many metrics, it's stronger than it's ever been. In particular, the state has a great deal of reserves and cash on hand to, you know, pay incoming bills. You know, revenues exceed expenses. Debt is at some of the lowest levels in decades. You know, so on the whole, the state's financial position is very strong. It's worth noting that we are going to see that soften somewhat this year in 2024. But to some degree, that's to be expected because, you know, I mean, there are needs in the state. There's this exceptionally large surplus. So elected officials are drawing on some of that to address issues in the state. And so I think it's worth watching because we want to, you know, we don't want it to weaken too much. But so far, you know, it's been a positive story.
So what is the current surplus and how does it compare to past years?
The state's general fund surplus, when you look at it through the kinds of accounting techniques used by publicly traded companies, that ended 2023 at $6.7 billion. You know, that is a level that we have never seen before, and that when I started looking at the state's finances 20 years ago, I thought would never happen. You know, really, the state has actually had a negative balance for most of the past 30 years, and it's only been since 2020 that the state has even been in positive territory. You know, we had 30 years essentially going all the way back to 1990 when we started, you know, when the state adopted these methods of accounting where the state had been running negative balances.
And so I understand from your report that one of the main contributing factors when we hear 2020, we think of the pandemic, there was a lot of federal relief aid. How much did that help with our finances and how would that compare to other states? Is this a national trend?
You know, it was a national trend that states did see an improvement in their finances. Some states then, you know, have since gotten themselves into trouble. So it's not universally the case that states are still in good shape, but this was a national trend. You know, the federal pandemic aid helped the state both directly and indirectly. It helped directly in that it addressed costs that the state had, you know, helped the state deal with problems that the state otherwise would have been financially on the hook for, like its Medicaid program and its unemployment payments to all the, you know, workers who didn't have a job in 2020. And then there's been indirect benefits. So, I mean, essentially, you know, all that stimulus juiced the economy. It caused, you know, a lot of economic activity. Sales tax revenues, income tax revenues for the state rose. And for a period of time, the state was pretty cautious or tight about spending that money. And, you know, that's a little less so in the current budget that just began in July of 2023 and that we're in now. But, you know, up until then, up until July of 2023, the state wasn't aggressively spending the money that it was taking in, you know, in some cases hand over fist. So that's how the surplus built up over the past several years.
I see. So when the report references actions of state leaders, is that primarily what you're referring to, the careful spending?
That's a component of it, to be sure. Yeah. And it varies in different ways. I mean, you know, it ranges from everything to how the state handled school aids to local school districts to, you know, how the state unemployment fund, which during the aughts really wasn't carrying the kind of reserves that it needs, you know, how that fund has been managed. And to some degree, that fund, you know, we can talk a little bit about where the work still needs to be done within state finances. And, you know, that's one area where there's still some room for improvement.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get into that. Because I saw that your report does stress our current financial strength is unlikely to continue. And you did mention keeping an eye on the unemployment fund. So what exactly would you be looking out for moving forward?
Well, I mean, essentially, the unemployment fund going into the pandemic had about $2 billion its balance. That in mid-2023 was at about $1.7 billion. And so, you know, although that's still relatively good, when you think about the inflation that has happened in people's wages and so forth, you know, the money just doesn't go as far today as it did 4 years ago, and so, or 5 years ago. And so the state, if you compare us to states nationally, we rank about 30th. So we're a little worse than the average state in terms of our how prepared our unemployment fund is to weather a recession. Right now, we could do maybe 7.5 months at a historically high payment rate. So in other words, if there was a pretty bad recession, you know, we wouldn't last a year with the reserves that we have right now. And the federal government recommends you be at a level where you could withstand a year of having to make those kind of payments. And there are benefits to the state if it can reach that level. Then if, God forbid, we have to take loans from the federal government to be able to keep making payments to unemployed workers like we did during the Great Recession, we could do that on an interest-free basis. Whereas that's something that we couldn't do right now because of where our fund level is at.
And so moving on to the general fund, you said this hot streak also likely won't continue. Can you walk me through some of the threats to that really high balance?
So, you know, again, to some degree, this is normal and not necessarily a bad thing. That the purpose of state government is to address people's problems, right? It's to have their taxes at the right level. It's to have their education, public safety services, streets, all the kind of services that we depend on from government. You know, that's the purpose that the state is there to serve, as opposed to, you know, piling up money and sitting on it. So it's not surprising or even concerning necessarily that the state is using some of that balance, but it is worth watching, right? Because we saw it during the 2000s and particularly during the Great Recession. State government in Wisconsin is capable of getting itself into financial trouble, and we don't want to be in that place again. Right now, when you look at the sort of budget-based accounting system that the state uses, you expect that in the current fiscal year that we're in right now, the balance in the state's main fund is going to fall by a little over $3 billion. So even though we had these balances that were up in the $7 billion range in the middle of last summer, when we get to the middle of this summer, it's probably going to be substantially lower than that. Again, is that cause for concern? Not really, because a lot of the spending that is causing the balance to fall is one-time in nature. So it's things like capital projects that, you know, we're not necessarily going to do that kind of spending again in the following year. But it's something that's worth watching going forward to make sure that the state does retain, you know, doesn't continue to whittle those reserves down to the point where they aren't sufficient anymore.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Jason.
Very good. Have a good afternoon. Thank you.
That was Jason Stein, Research Director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum.
Opponents of relaxing child labor laws were happy to see a recent attempt blocked in Wisconsin. But they contend there are still many issues to sort out in making sure minors aren't exploited by employers. Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection has the story.
Despite a recent policy victory, Wisconsin labor leaders still express concern about the current environment for shielding young teens from unsafe work environments. Governor Tony Evers this month vetoed a bill that would have expanded the elimination of required work permits for those under 18. The bill's language applied to 14- and 15-year-olds, several years after the state did away with parental permission for 16- and 17-year-olds. Wisconsin State AFL-CIO President Stephanie Bloomingdale says these are policy fights advocates thought they won decades ago when minors often worked in dangerous conditions. But she says there's a strong push to chip away at protections.
We are seeing a growing movement from different unscrupulous employers that want to put kids back in the workplace and not have the kind of oversight that is needed.
The Economic Policy Institute says rollbacks have been approved in a dozen states the past few years. And while current efforts are thwarted in Wisconsin, Bloomingdale worries about similar debates in future sessions. Meanwhile, violations are trending upward, with the U.S. Labor Department reporting an 83% increase in financial penalties. Backers of the Wisconsin bill say the goal was to reduce red tape for families. But Bloomingdale says taking away another layer of protection does more to trample on the rights of parents and guardians. And with higher consumer prices placing more pressure on household budgets, she says some kids might feel the need to bring in additional income. But she adds the current law helps the whole family make an informed decision.
It's important for kids to get a good work ethic. But at the same time, these kids need to make sure that they are getting enough sleep, that they are able to participate in their school, and really making sure that that balance is there.
The EPI report says amid the push in many states to weaken these laws, several other states have advanced bills to strengthen protections. And there have been bipartisan bills in Congress that, among other things, would crack down on violators. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thanks for joining us.
On this week's Madison's Backbone, feature contributor Riley Cutright talks to Grace, a music therapist. Grace shares her insights on the many working parts of healthcare and how music therapy offers unique and necessary support to the patients, to patients of all ages.
A community is a unified body of individuals sharing something in common. Over a quarter of a million people call Madison, Wisconsin their home. Have you ever wondered about the secret to Madison's vibrant and unique community? Well, I have the answer for you. Workers. This segment features the working voices who undeniably strengthen and brighten Madison's community on the daily. I'm Riley Cutright, and this is Madison's Backbone. I'm here with Grace, who is a music therapist.
Hello, my name is Grace Parlier. I'm a board-certified music therapist. I've been working as a music therapist full-time since January of 2022, so it's a little over a year now. I went to school at El Verno College in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where they have one of the oldest music therapy programs in the nation. It's also a super awesome women's college. And then I did my internship at a hospital setting in Minnesota, and then have working in a variety of settings in my 1 year for a private practice. I worked with children, a variety of developmental and social skill needs, and now I work in hospice, mostly with older adults.
How did you get your start as a music therapist? You said that you went to college.
I did. I knew I wanted to study music, and I wanted to get a bachelor's in music somewhere so that I'd have a full music degree that I could apply elsewhere. And so I had a cousin who worked at El Verno and spoke really highly of the school, and that was the only program they had in music was music therapy. So I met with the professor when I was like a junior in high school and loved what she was telling me about. It's like clinical use of music for a variety of goals. And so it's this idea that we have music so rooted in ourselves as people. And so we're maximizing that relationship with music for a variety of goals that could impact people the rest of their life or just provide kind of an acute support at the moment. I just thought it was the coolest thing. College, it was a 4-year program. And then to be a board certified music therapist, you do a 4-year degree or sometimes 4.5-year degree. And then you do an internship that's about 1,000 hours. So I did my internship, and then you take a board certification test, and then you are officially a board certified music therapist. And that's how I got my start.
What do you do in your work day?
Currently, I work for a private practice, so it's a very clean way to approach music therapy. Like, you're not typically in an environment where you're asked to do a lot of non-music therapy things. So I go and see individual clients because my current contract is in hospice. Today, I saw 5 different folks. Some were at the same facility, so that made it nice and easy. But I drive to them. I do sessions. My sessions are typically 45 minutes to an hour, but it really depends on, you know, what person needs. Some days are a little chaotic or interrupted because I'm fortunate to work with an awesome team. So if somebody's in acute crisis and medication isn't working at end of life, they'll call in music therapy for additional support, specifically for like respiration support or pain distraction or redirection is what we call it. And so some days I'll be called to do something else to support the team's needs. But I do that, and then I document my sessions on software, and I sometimes have meetings with other, through my company, we have meetings with other professionals to talk about clinical practice and, you know, expanding our minds and how we work with our folks. But yeah, a lot of driving, documenting, and seeing cool people every day. when I worked with kids, I saw everybody in homes. So I went to individual homes and I had bubbles floating around my car.
How long is your work day?
I managed to get it done in about 8 hours. When I was working with the kids, some days I would do kind of a stacked day, and I'd do like 2 10-hour days after all the driving and documenting and everything. It added up to be about that much. So it's a pretty standard. Now that I'm working in hospice, my work schedule has become more of a 9-to-5. But when I was working with children, you had to accommodate school schedules. And so I worked kind of a similar hours to like private music instructors, where you see everybody between like 3 p.m. and 6 o'clock. And then like earlier in your day is a lot of prepping and planning or seeing people that have that daytime availability.
So if you're looking for a job that offers some flexibility, but also if you want to work evenings, this might be the job for you.
Yeah, it's been kind of cool, at least like in the network of music therapists, it's a largely women-dominated field. And so you have a lot of women that are then mothers. And so a lot of people are starting their own practices, like private practices, which is just them as like a sole proprietor LLC. And they're, you know, working to have a smaller caseload, but they can take all the profits from their services. And music therapy can be reimbursed through certain like Medicaid waivers and such. And so there is good money to make that is like consistent money that then can support a diverse populace of clients. But then like more and more people that are music therapists are choosing to kind of just run their own show. And it, you know, it takes the work of doing your own billing and all sorts of other stuff that allows them to practice therapy both in line with their values, but then have that flexibility and that kind of ownership. So a lot like music educators or like private studio runners.
What is the most difficult part about your job?
It was interesting when I worked with children, the most difficult part was a lot of times feeling like there's so much that's happening in this child's life and music therapy can be this really cool like breakthrough point. And then feeling like I wasn't making those breakthroughs because I didn't have enough generalization of the environment. Like I wasn't in a school setting or able to contact, you know, all their providers in an effective way. And so I think part of it in most helping professions feeling like the work isn't done or that it's only a small portion of what's going to help an individual. Now that I work in hospice, a lot of it is just assessing like there is grief in the fact that like how we're working with older adults or dying people is the amount of resources they're actually given, and acknowledging in most helping professions that people are under-resourced. And so that quality of life piece or that like being that extra little sauce in somebody's day of like, oh, and then even though I have all these other needs or all these, you know, other medical, physiological, psychosocial, whatever, music is brought in to help me too, has been something that like flips the script or gives some levity, but it definitely can have its hard days where you're like, this just isn't enough or, you know, people just need more. I'm sure anybody working with people struggles with that too.
What do you think like a good amount of resource would look like, or how would you feel most like supported in your job? Is this kind of, if I'm understanding you correctly?
Yeah, I feel like I have sufficient resources. I think the hardest part is like acknowledging, well, I can only help so much, but it's like I'm there with my guitar, but then somebody's at a state-funded facility where they just, the nursing staff is really short, and so the call light's been on for 40 minutes or so, and they haven't, you know, just gotten a basic care done. And so just knowing that, like, there is just inequity in healthcare and being kind of an accessory or feeling like an accessory piece in healthcare as a music therapist. Like, I'm there and I know that my role has worth and can be really impactful for some folks, especially those that are experiencing so much lower quality of life with where they're at. And so much of working with older adults is, like, how well that individual planned for disease or planned for aging. And so when you look at people that are chronically under-resourced, people with mental illness or people that have a lot of, you know, chronic health problems or just did not have a lot of financial literacy or came into financial hardship their entire lives, you see them at end of life and they're like, they have the basic maybe met, and then you're just there to kind of provide additional support where you can. But, and two, like being on the road, like personally feeling under-resourced is like the idea of you're popping into certain places instead of being a figurehead there or like really knowing all of the key players in specific facilities. It does take more legwork to like build those networks so that you can best help your patient, even if you're only there for your 45 minutes to an hour, but to make sure that like you know the nurse's name so that, or volunteers' names or activity coordinators' names at these different nursing homes to make sure that when you leave, there are supports or there are coping strategies for your folks that are meaningful and can actually make their whole day good and not just an hour of it.
Thanks for tuning in to Madison's Backbone this week. We'll catch you in 2 weeks for part two of what it's like working as a music therapist.
And it's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather guru Rob McClure.
Well, last evening's round of thunderstorms turned out pretty much as the forecast models had predicted back on Monday, both in terms of timing and intensity, and we were concerned that some of those storms might be severe. Despite a fair amount of rotation evident on radar with a number of the cells last evening, and even a couple of tornado warnings issued for the cluster of cells that passed northward through Lafayette County and up just west of Madison, there were no verified spin-ups so far as I know, and just a handful of hail and wind damage reports when all was said and done. So we did luck out in that regard. You could certainly tell those thunderstorms were warm frontally related. If you happen to go out after they passed last night, the dew point temperature leapt from the low 40s in the late afternoon to the mid or even upper 50s by 8 or 9 p.m. That's a 50% increase, incidentally, in moisture, so quite noticeable. Indeed, it kept the temperature up near 60 degrees through the overnight, so even this morning it felt more like we'd just been through a summer night than one in mid-April. Incidentally, it's that the energy and buoyancy associated with that incoming surge of low-level moisture, along with a quick veering of winds from east to south, that makes these springtime warm fronts, especially fast-moving ones like yesterday's, hazardous in terms of severe weather and tornado development. If you have a look at the visible satellite image of the upper Midwest that we have linked on the WORT weather webpage this evening, you'll see the now occluding storm that brought us that warm front yesterday, wheeling slowly northeastward out of the area from central Wisconsin up across upper Michigan. But no sooner does the sky begin to clear out to the west than another surge of clouds, high clouds in this case, pushes in from the central plains. So we may get some clearing during this overnight, but it won't last terribly long, I'm afraid. The incoming clouds are associated with another approaching low-pressure system, this one down in the Panhandle region and set to eject across southern Illinois rather than central Wisconsin. This storm would not ordinarily tend to spread its precipitation this far north, but it's going to be passing tomorrow in concert with an incoming upper trough and surge of colder air that will be traveling in from the northwest. You can see this if you have a look at one of the water vapor views of the continent that we have available on the WORT weather webpage. That upper trough is currently pushing southward across the Dakotas into northern Minnesota and will provide just enough additional impetus upward to saturate the air column deeply enough for at least spotty showers tomorrow, though those will be likely more prevalent in the south parts of the listening area closer to the system down in Illinois. The cooler air approaching from Canada beneath the upper trough will be the dominant weather feature then from later tomorrow on through the weekend, though a return of upper ridging and warmer air early next week will likely start the thermometer, I think, rising already by Sunday. Overnight temperatures will be flirting with freezing over this coming weekend, so if you're toying with the idea of putting out maybe some early peppers or tomatoes, you might want to hold off until Monday anyway. But back to the forecast for the specifics, tonight the stratocumulus deck overhead will continue to thin from west to east and perhaps become a little bit more cellular before the sun goes down, so you might get one last glimpse of the sun before it sets if you're lucky. Temperatures will drop to the mid-40s by dawn, though much of that drop is going to be past midnight as the skies clear more and the winds finally come down, and they will come down to about 5 to 10 miles per hour by dawn. Tomorrow, clouds are likely to be on the increase already by sunrise or shortly after, with a lowering of the deck then through the morning hours and light precipitation starting up perhaps as early as 9 or 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock anyway. It'll move in from west to east across the region. Rains will generally be light, but they may continue fairly steadily for a while tomorrow, then maybe more off and on in the afternoon. Amounts will generally be light overall, but those showers will be heavier to the south of Madison and lighter to the north. Temperatures will hold in the low 50s through the day, given the cloud cover and showers. Winds will be northwesterly, fairly light at 4 to 8 miles per hour. Skies will clear from northwest to southeast in the evening and overnight tomorrow, and low temperatures will drop down to probably the upper 30s on light west and northwest winds by dawn Friday. And on Friday, a more concerted push of Canadian air is going to ratchet up the northwesterly winds again, up to probably 12 to 20 miles per hour or so, with some gustiness in the afternoon as well. And that'll hold temperatures to around 50 or the low 50s. Clear morning skies may see some cumulus and stratocumulus development midday. That would be especially true in the more northern parts of the listing area. Temperatures will drop to the mid-30s then in the overnight, held up by westerly winds, still up at 8 to 12 miles per hour. And Saturday will be mostly sunny and in the 50-degree range anyway, again with brisk northwest to northwest winds at 12 to 17 miles per hour. Diurnal cloud development might hold temperatures in the upper 40s that day. Clearing in the overnight will take temperatures back into the low 30s, and Sunday will be mostly sunny with a high temperature back in the low 50s. At the moment, at the station down here on Bedford Street in Madison, the temperature is 55 degrees. The dew point temperature is 44. Winds are west at 12 miles per hour, still gusting up above 25 miles per hour with some frequency. And last I looked out, the holes in the overcast have filled back in, so we're overcast at about 2,900 feet, and the barometer is rising rapidly at 29.79 inches of mercury.
We go now to April 1964 for civil rights demonstrations, big downtown developments, a near-death experience for urban renewal, and a rock and roll legend. Stu Levitan has the news from 60 years ago this month on tonight's Madison in the 60s. All the years come by. They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, April 1964. As the month opens, members of the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, are continuing their boycott and picketing of the Sears store on East Washington Avenue, where only one of the store's 321 employees is black, a maintenance worker. CORE Publicity Director Leah Zeldin says many customers have canceled their store charge accounts in support of CORE's demand the store hire more black workers. Although CORE does not file a formal complaint with the Equal Opportunities Commission, the EOC holds a public hearing under its plenary power to investigate possible discrimination. About 60 persons attend the April 6th hearing, where the testimony is compelling but inconclusive. When the EOC closes its file without action on April 14th, Sears has 3 full-time and 4 part-time black employees. CORE President Silas Norman congratulates the store and urges it to do more. The country's most prominent opponent of the civil rights bill being debated in Congress, and one of its most important supporters, both visit Madison this month. On April 2nd, about 20 CORE activists picket in the cold rain as Alabama Governor George Wallace brings his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination to the West Side for a speech to the Madison Exchange Club at the Cuba Club. Wallace denies he is racially prejudiced and draws applause for his attack on the pending federal civil rights bill as something, quote, that will destroy the constitutional rights of everybody. Club members give him a warm reception. On the 25th, the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, a co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, rouses a Capitol Square crowd of about 500 with his emphatic call for adoption of state and federal civil rights legislation. UW freshman Tracy Nelson, the young folk blues singer from Shorewood Hills, is among the entertainers at the rally sponsored by the Madison Committee for Civil Rights. On the 27th, about 30 college and high school students from the Madison CORE chapter sitting in the balcony of the assembly chambers engage in the first civil rights demonstration to disrupt the Wisconsin legislature in support of their demand for a special session on civil rights legislation. While the assembly sergeant-at-arms brusquely confiscates their several unauthorized signs, the group stands to sing "We Shall Overcome," annoying the assembly so much it adjourns. There are no arrests, and the group marches out singing. Corp Chapter Chair Silas Norman opposes the action and resigns and leaves about a month later for the Selma Literacy Project. He is succeeded by Bortai Scudder, daughter of British modernist poet Basil Bunting. Residents of the Greenbush neighborhood had been angry at the Madison Redevelopment Authority for years over the way it turned their homes and businesses into the Triangle Urban Renewal Project. But it was only when the MRA started looking at property around the university that political opposition became a threat. A group composed largely of small property owners called the Madison Homeowners Association filed almost 8,000 signatures and gets a referendum on the April ballot to, quote, terminate all urban renewal activities and abolish the MRA. The entire political establishment, Mayor Henry Reynolds, University President Fred Harvey Harrington, and both newspapers all forcefully opposed the referendum. But on April 7th, the vote comes down to the last precinct reporting, with 36,665 votes cast, representing 70% of registered voters. The MRA survives by 367 votes, 18,516 to 18,149. The Ninth Ward, home of the Triangle and Brittingham projects, and the Near East Side Sixth Ward, where many are bitterly opposed to an ongoing study of the Marquette neighborhood, both vote heavily to end all urban renewal activities, while the 14th Ward, where residents favor the South Madison Project, votes heavily to continue. It's strong support from West Side wards that keep the MRA alive. But urban renewal itself kills the political careers of two East Side incumbent alders, including a member of the MRA, the 6th Ward alder who sponsored the MRA's study in the neighborhood. The MRA's public relations consultant later says they should have built low-cost public housing as their first project next to Brittingham Park rather than the market-rate apartments they approved. And in another kind of development, on the 24th, a proposal to transform State Street. Madison Properties Incorporated, the development firm owned by Gerald Bartell and Robert Brooks, announces plans for a 10-story Holiday Inn in the 400 block of State Street, with the entry to its 167-car garage off West Willman Street. The parcel has been vacant since Victor Music burned down in December 1961. Bartell says he has an accepted offer from Meyer Victor and hopes to begin construction by late July. Big doings on campus the weekend of the 17th and 18th. While the legendary Bo Diddley rocks the military ball in Great Hall on Friday night with Ken Annamani's band The Night Trains on the bill, folk singer Guy Carawan, the man who first popularized We Shall Overcome, is singing for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee at the University YMCA. Saturday night, it's a Bo Diddley album and nickel bags of popcorn for the 1,000 who pack Great Hall for the Student Peace Center's 8th Annual Anti-Military Ball. There's great live music, too, for the largest turnout yet. Tracy Nelson, sitting in with a Johnny Calba Blues Band. Responding to the release earlier this year of the Surgeon General's report linking cigarettes to lung cancer, the Common Council for the first time sets a city age limit on smoking. Reasoning that smoking and drinking beer should have the same legal age, the council initially sets the smoking age at 18. But after the Madison Youth Council calls this an infringement of personal liberty and urges education rather than enforcement, the council reverses its decision and sets the legal smoking age to 16. Madison Youth Council Vice President Eugene Parks, noting the many alders smoking during the meeting, says his group doesn't condone smoking, but, quote, we feel this is the responsibility of the youth and his parents. Nadine Goff, editor of the Central High School Mirror, tells the council that a survey shows that almost 30% of Central senior high students and nearly 20% of junior high students smoke or had smoked. And after receiving many complaints about dogs running loose in city parks, the Parks Commission bans man's best friend from 7 city parks. Maybe we need a dog park, suggests Commissioner Mrs. George Hansen. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported WRT News team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for our show this evening. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. As we occasionally mention, this show is largely put together by volunteers, and we could use your help if you'd like to volunteer as a reporter or a feature producer or a writer. We'd love to have you down here. We'll provide all the training, so it's quite a good deal. Give the station a call at 256-2001 during business hours if you're interested. Our headline writer this evening was Greg Sanderson. Special thanks to feature contributors Riley Cutright and Stu Levitan. Thanks to Mike Mullen of the Wisconsin News Connection. Katie Churchella was our on-air engineer this evening. As always, Faye Parks produced the newscast, and Charlie Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.